Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. The theme of women in 20th century literature as a topic seemed to be very exciting and challenging. It gave me the opportunity to crystallize many thoughts that I had had over a period of perhaps two decades of being a woman writer in the 20th century. And I thought it would be very interesting to approach the image of woman with a capital W, kind of an allegorical figure, through the prismatic and sometimes distorting lens of the male imagination. With my usual overzealousness, I must have 40 or 50 pages here, but do not be frightened. I will not read more than enough for perhaps 1 hour. So I began by, in a rather scholarly fashion, contrasting the pretensions of modernism, the high elite modernism of the 20th century, exemplified by people like William Butler Yeats, T.S. Eliot, D.H. Lawrence, James Joyce, and Faulkner. I contrasted modernism with popular culture of the 19th century, which it's all very interesting to see people actually trying to get into a lecture hall. Since I've been a professor for many, many years, it's you know, the flow of motion is usually in the opposite direction, so we'll see how long it stays that way. So I began by contrasting modernism with popular culture of the late 19th century, much of which had been written by women, the romantic, sentimental, popular, religious, moralistic novels of people like Mrs. Southworth and Mary Jane Evans and others. And I found something very interesting, that the stereotypical ideas of women, the ideal of womanhood that was presented in the romantic and very sentimental popular culture is more or less the same as the image of woman that's held very high and very high esteem by these high modernist writers. I then talked about Yeats. And I think that for today, I'll just begin with what is, in a sense, the second part of this long paper. I will owe it to the Free Library of Philadelphia if this evolves into a book or a monograph. When I get very interested in something, it seems that so much crystallizes and gets added to it over a period of time. So I'll begin with the second part, and I'll be talking about writers very familiar to all of you, I'm sure. I'll talk about John Updike, whom I admire very much. I think he's a marvelous writer. It may seem that I'm somewhat critical of him in an ideological sense, but this doesn't carry with it a criticism really on a literary level. And I'll talk a little bit about Richard Wright, William Faulkner, Norman Mailer, William Styron, Sophie's Choice in particular. If I have time, I'll talk about D.H. Lawrence and spend some time on Lawrence. Of all these writers, D.H. Lawrence seems to be the supreme genius, but the others are very instructive in what they reveal about male notions of the female role. Denis de Rougemont's Love in the Western World, which was written in 1939 in France and translated to English in 1954, makes the provocative statement that our Western culture suffers from, quote, an inescapable conflict between passion and marriage. To those of us who are married, that's a rather depressing kind of first sentence to begin with. The inescapable and perhaps even tragic conflict between passion and marriage. De Rougemont ingeniously analyzes the legend of Tristan and Isolde to discover an imperfectly understood conflict between the two religions of honor on one hand and passion. This has to be understood as a really ongoing tradition in which there is a religious context, namely Christianity, in which honor is very, very important. Passion becomes therefore illicit and more or less banished. The lovers, Tristan and Isolde, are in love not with each other, but with love itself. Their existence in love, their own immersion in love, is the highest consideration. Their happiness thus originates in a false reciprocity, which disguises a twin narcissism. Passionate love, the longing for what wears us and annihilates us in its triumph, this is the secret which Europe has never allowed to be given away, a secret it has always repressed and preserved. De Rougemont postulates throughout our literature an underground and unconscious cult of love, always adulterous, betraying, unfaithful, and illicit. The essence of this love is passion itself and not possession. It's not knowledge of the other person or true intimacy, but the stirring of passion in the lover, and it's usually from the point of view of the male. Not the other person, but the lover's state of mind, his emotions, is the focus of excited interest. Isolde becomes a figure of male fantasy, the unattainable female, valued because she is unattainable. The distance between passion and possession provides us with a drama. I'll talk about some works of John Updike's that are, I assume, familiar with many of you. The title story of John Updike's collection, Museums and Women, is quite explicit in its statement of this theme, which is, moreover, a theme that resonates throughout Updike's work, from the early Maple stories in which romance and domesticity are first in an affectionate and then in a disturbing conflict, to the luxuriant cynicism of Updike's African novel, The Coup, in which a deposed African ruler is forced to define himself by way of his several former wives. I think that's a marvelous novel. This is kind of parenthetical comments. The Coup is a marvelous novel. It's like a coup of language, a city of words. And though it's from the point of view of an African, supposedly a deposed African ruler, his relationship with his various wives sounds to us extremely familiar if we're at all familiar with Updike. In Museums and Women, Updike says that both museums and women, quote, suggest radiance, antiquity, mystery, and duty. They inspire moods of reverence and dread. It is significant that the museum's first association is with the writer's mother, the most intimate of all female presences, yet in a sense the least attainable. The story is a prose poem rhapsodically and with a delicate melancholy, musing upon emotion, nostalgia, inevitable loss, like in fact most of Updike's fiction. Updike says, "What is nostalgia but love for that part of ourselves which is in heaven, forever removed from change and corruption? A woman loved momentarily eases the pain of time by localizing nostalgia. The vague and irrevocable objects of nostalgic longing are assimilated under the pressure of libidinous desire into the details of her person." One doesn't know whether to be flattered by that or extremely depressed, you know. I think it's very interesting that a man will speak so explicitly about the experience from his point of view. So the female, with a capital F, affects a kind of magic, less in her individuality than in her secret resonance in the male's fantasy life. She is not a person, but an allegorical figure in his life's drama. Updike says, quote, "Perhaps it is to the degree that the beloved crystallizes the lover's past that she presents herself to him as his fate, though I might add that the lover's future too is involved in a half-articulated sense of himself, which, left unheralded, would never bloom into fruition." That is, in somewhat simpler language. I think that we come together and make of one another something that which is not there already, but is potentially there. The story Museums and Women is in itself a loosely nostalgic piece in which several women, the writer's wife and his several mistresses, are evoked in terms of museums the lovers had visited together. What is illuminating is the fact that both Museums and Women are, in Updike's imagination, emotionally equivalent, inanimate, passive places to visit, to admire, to examine, and to leave. A woman is not a presence in herself with her own nostalgic longings, her history, her future, her individuality. She is a region of the masculine soul experienced in a curious way without being known. Updike's autobiographical narrator comes upon a statuette of a nude asleep on a mattress in an unnamed museum. I think this is made of marble. She was a dainty white dream, an 18th century fancy. As I stood gazing into the eternal privacy of her sleep, I was disturbed by dread and a premonition of loss. Why? Was my wife not also fair and finely formed and mute? The other woman is asleep. She is ideal. Updike muses upon this anonymous statuette with the same concern for the nuances of feeling of the inner life he brings to his study of real women. We seemed about to release each other from twin enchantments. Was not my huge face the oppressive dream that was making her stir? The problem is, however, that both Museums and Women, once entered, the figure of speech is Updike's, begin to lose their enchantment. The masculine response to possession, as illumined by Updike, is very close to that postulated by de Rougemont. Not possession, but passion. Not domesticity, but mystery. Distance, the unattainable assault. This is the male's secret desire. Does Updike dramatize adolescent, wistful, yearning states of mind rather in the vein of Scott Fitzgerald? Or is he, in certain disturbing respects, simply dramatizing a masculine or even very human predicament? I'm really not able to know that. And John Updike himself perhaps has not resolved this. John is, in a way, a friend of mine whom I don't see often. And when we're together, we tend not to talk about literary things. It's more on the level of gossip about other people. But I think that's really very interesting. I read his work for a long time, and I would, you know, ask that question again. Is he dramatizing what is basically adolescent and immature romantic fantasy in the vein of Scott Fitzgerald? Or is he dramatizing something more profoundly basic to our human experience? Updike has said in more than one interview in defense of the immaturity of his character Rabbit Angstrom in the novel Rabbit Run, which is very fine now. John is defensive about Rabbit. He says that he thinks very much the way Rabbit does and wonders if maturity isn't a tiresome and overrated value. I wouldn't want to admit to thinking the way Rabbit thinks. And perhaps some of you who read the novel recently concur or disagree with that. At the end of the novel, Rabbit Run, Rabbit literally runs away. He just literally runs away from a funeral. Still, there is something chilling and cynical beneath the melodic surface of Updike's prose. Quote, "It came to me suddenly that nothing about museums is as splendid as their entrances, the sudden vault, the shapely cornices. And it appeared to me that now I was condemned in my search for the radiance that had faded behind me to enter more and more museums and to be a little less exalted by each new entrance and a little more quickly disenchanted by the familiar contents beyond." Of course, he's talking about women. As with museums, so with women, though one wonders how another human being can become so quickly familiar, do we all plumb one another's depths with such ease? I think that's where I probably part company with Updike, in thinking that we never should become disenchanted with one another, because in fact we never really know one another that well. It's a kind of superficial and immature notion to think that entering a museum, entering a woman's life and so forth, that one can then understand the depths so very easily. I think that is a point at which I do disagree. If Updike's wistful male lovers are predators of a sort, forever seeking in Derougemont's vocabulary an image to gratify their own narcissism, it's the case, too, that both male and female seem locked in twin enchantments, trapped in a delusion of adolescence, which has very much to do with the general spirit or mood of adolescence of our country, the United States. The lover's obsession with his own feelings translates fairly reasonably into the writer's obsession with his own language. The act of writing, like the act of loving, being in a sense promiscuous, for it can address itself in theory to any object. What is exhilarating is not the subject, but the process of writing, the triumph of style over context. It's Auden who says, in some, I think it's in a poem, or perhaps it's in an essay, where a young woman should beware of her lover who is writing poetry about her, because when he writes the poetry, he's not writing about her, but about his own emotion. And his own emotion, perhaps, is more interesting than she is. But that's Auden, who is very cynical. I think I would have been cynical, too, if I were Auden. That seems like a very catty remark that I will not develop. One finds throughout Updike's fiction this air of melancholy romance in which moments of genuine passion erupt but quickly fade into memory and into language. For Updike ceaselessly converts private experience into fiction, as the recent collection of short stories which came out in paperback and was serialized on television, Too Far to Go, makes clear. The forthright delineation of a marriage that begins with great love and energy and optimism and gradually atrophies in a kind of way paradigmatic, I think, of innocence in general. One wonders what might be made of Updike's work examined in the light of T.S. Eliot's famous remark, "A work of art is successful insofar as it is the objective correlative of the writer's emotion. It fails only if it is a confession." In Couples, which has been, I think, Updike's most popular success. In the novel Couples, Updike's hero Pete, while playing a parlor game with friends in which one is asked what is the most wonderful thing imaginable, says, "A sleeping woman, because when she is sleeping, she becomes all women." The romance of adultery is explored here in sometimes excessive detail, and Updike makes explicit the diminishment of the wife, who is known as measured against the value of the mistress. This is Foxy. You probably do remember the novel. It's, I think, very well done novel, very interesting. Pete pities his attractive wife, Angela. Quote, "She was considering herself as useful, still useful to him, exploring herself bravely toward a new exploitation when, to him, she was exhausted, a stale labyrinth whose turnings must be negotiated to reach fresh air and Foxy being the wife of a friend." I didn't italicize these words, but the repetition of "to him," I think, is instructive. She's considering herself useful to him. She's his wife, but she doesn't know that she's been exhausted in his imagination. There's a very apt and ironic touch at the novel's conclusion when Pete and Foxy divorce their mates and marry each other and move away, quote, "and become accepted in another community as another couple." And presumably the round of adultery and illicit longings will then begin once again. In Updike's most recent collection of stories, Problems, the theme of the untainable Isolde, who metamorphoses into a domesticated presence, is cogently explored in a story called The Fairy Godfathers, in which adulterous lovers named Pumpkin, this is the woman, and Todd suggests death, the German Tad, attain an exalted status in each other's eyes by way of their respective psychoanalysts, who listen tirelessly to their, quote, deep though fathomable well of sorrow and narcissistic muddle. Dramatizing their emotions, their predicaments, the rather familiar curve of their ambivalent feelings toward each other and their betrayed families, the lovers are semi-legendary. They acquire a radiance not really their own, rather like Tristan and Isolde. They seem sometimes, as they moved about the city enacting their romance, gloves on the hands of giants, embodiments of others' hopes. They were happy in limbo. Then, suddenly the drama recedes, romance gives way to habitude. And the story ends with this very sad paragraph. The first time I read it, I was kind of shocked because I do know John Updike's second wife. One, you know, we really have to be very, very courageous to marry poets and writers of the male gender, I think. Though if I had been the husband of Erica Jong, I think I'd be very nervous or walk around with a paper bag over my head or something. So when I read this paragraph, I really did a double take. It seems so cynical and profoundly demoralizing. The world rotated, the children stopped crying, the pace of legal action slowed, the city lights faded. They bought a house. For economy's sake, they stopped seeing psychiatrists. Now when she said to him, "You're beautiful," it came only from her. And when he answered, "So are you," it was to quell the terror that visited them, stark as daylight, plain as the mailman. For Todd was death, and Pumpkin was hollow, and the fairy godfathers had vanished, taking with them the lover's best selves. It is instructive to note that Updike evidently believes that the illusory self of romance is our best self. Where another imagination, one could think of Virginia Woolf, for instance, or the great Victorian novelist, George Eliot, Charles Dickens, Hardy, where this other imagination would argue that the best self in us is in fact the domesticated, familiar, known self of a long protracted intimacy, Updike writes increasingly wistful stories in which the reverse is presented. Not the other person, the woman, but the lover's state of mind is the crucial factor. This is another part of the paper, which has a tentative title, Retribution. I had lots of different titles for the whole paper. One of the first one was on being despised. And I wrote that out and I thought it seems so masochistic. It's like something that might come from Southern California. So Joan Didion. So I scratched that. And another title, I thought it was Cautionary Tales, Fairy Tales, Grimm's Fairy Tales and so forth, are generally known as cautionary tales, or tales told children in order to really frighten them very much. And I think that the half-conscious, half-buried logic of many of the stories that women come upon in literature are cautionary tales about what happens if a woman ventures outside her usual sphere. Then another title, which is too long and unwieldy as a title, but has a kind of dreadful symbolic weight. Quote, "At least I have made a woman of her," unquote. Joe Christmas in Light in August. This is after he's been raping this woman, and he finally murders her. He slashes her throat so terribly violently that her head, Faulkner describes this in wonderful detail, her corpse is picked up and her head swings right around and almost falls off. You know, it's, "At least I have made a woman of her." The imagination of John Updike, while in a sense ceaselessly exploitive, is fundamentally a celebration. His art is Joycean and Proustian, which is to say, epiphany-centered, image-centered, modernist in its devotion to the craft of saying things correctly and precisely, and reverent of its material. I could expand upon that. I think John Updike has a painter's, an artist, a visual artist's eye, and that he's really much in love with the physical world and in love with language, and he wants to bring them into a fine conjunction. He's Joycean and Proustian in that respect. The, quote, sleeping woman who is Updike's secret muse is perhaps all women, which is to say woman with a capital W. Hence an inviolable ideal, a genuine value, whether individual women are exploited or not. And I think this is a real difference between Updike and many other writers, male writers today. By contrast, there is a masculine imagination in which the image of woman is much darker, burdened with obsessive preoccupations, turning upon the notion of the woman as the object of sexual desire in the male, being somehow contaminated by that desire, causing it, being to blame for it, and deserving of punishment. Here the perpetually adolescent lover of romantic fiction gives way to the censorious judge, the rapist, the murderer in the male imagination. These are images that, of course, many women, activists, feminists today are responding to in popular culture and movies and pornographic books and so forth. But they are also images deeply embodied in presumably serious culture, a more elite literary tradition as well. It's interesting to note that in American literature of the 19th century, masculine energies could unleash themselves by, quote, lighting out for the territory, to use Huckleberry Finn's famous phrase, heading west or south to Mexico or north to Alaska, or like Melville's Ishmael, going out to sea out of a, quote, drizzly November of the soul that might very well result in suicide if Ishmael had remained landlocked. And those of you who are familiar with our great 19th century literature, which I think is just supremely wonderful literature, you're familiar with the sense of expansiveness that one can move somewhere, and people do move in various directions. By contrast, 20th century literature written by men in America turns these primitive energies against women in ways that vary from the relative subtlety with which D.H. Lawrence destroys a woman artist in Women in Love, which I note that Women in Love, the film, was shown in the first of these series. And if there was discussion or a lecture in connection with that film, it may have been mentioned that Gudrun, who is the woman artist in Women in Love, is based upon Lawrence's idea of Catherine Mansfield, his idea of Catherine Mansfield, which is extremely distorted, and perhaps in some ways he understood her and identified with it. In other ways, it's a very distorted picture. So these primitive energies vary from the relative subtlety with which Lawrence destroys a woman artist to the more explicit and far more savage murders of women in such representative novels as Faulkner's Light in August, which is 1932, Richard Wright's Native Son, 1940, Norman Mailer's An American Dream, 1965, and William Styron's Sophie's Choice, which I think was just last year, 1980, a very controversial novel. Everyone I met, including many writers, either liked that novel very much or hated it very much. It's difficult for anyone to have no opinion about Sophie's Choice. Richard Wright's novel was a bestseller and something of a literary event in 1940. It was called by enthusiastic reviewers as a work comparable to Dostoevsky. Upon review, the novel seems to be extremely crudely written, and in an ironic way, it promotes the very image of the primitive, lawless, and murderous black man that has become a stereotype in white consciousness. I guess it's always been a stereotype in white consciousness. The protagonist of Native Son Bigger Thomas is presented as a homicidal maniac at times. His murder of a white woman, quote, of liberal tendencies, satisfies both fantasies of black men in their rage against whites and white men in their rage against white women who consort with blacks. Norman Mailer's somewhat hastily written novel, An American Dream, I know he wrote it deliberately very, very fast. He wanted to see if he could duplicate Dostoevsky writing Crime and Punishment, or Dickens writing, you know, for Serial. I'm going to be meeting Norman Mailer this evening for the first time in my life, so I can't exactly be betraying our friendship ahead of time. I will probably find him very, very... I was going to say something nice, like very sweet and so forth, but I think I'll skip that. I'll probably find him very Mailer-esque. But An American Dream, I think, is a strange, it's very, very fast written novel. I think if it's read fast, it's not as offensive. Well, the novel presents a protagonist whose philosophizing and ruminations are very close to Mailer's own. One would not want to call the protagonist Rorjak Mailer because he's a murderer and very, very long-winded. One wouldn't want to say that was Mailer, but it's somewhat close to Mailer. He murders his wealthy wife in a scene that's almost like a sadistic love scene. He's sexually involved with a nightclub singer who, as she is described by Mailer, has the depth and the dimensions of a Playboy centerfold. This woman, too, is finally killed, not by Rorjak, but because of him. So with masculine authority intact and sexual authority not to be doubted, Mailer's persona hero triumphs over these women who are themselves too sexually knowing, and then he is freed of his problem. Mailer has said that he had been required by instinct some years ago to stab one of his wives. Otherwise, in line with his curious, superstitious mind, he believed he would have contracted cancer and died of cancer. A diagnosis that would be amusing if it were not disquieting, for perhaps the cancer is nothing other than passivity, a feminization of the masculine primitive energies, not to stab one's wife, not by way of a vicarious fictional strategy to murder the, quote, unfeminine female, is to succumb in Mailer's imagination to the, quote, disease of being civilized, restrained, and mature, to the equilibrium of loving and receiving love. Since birth control is practiced by women, gives a woman the power of refusing her impregnator's sperm, this is in The Prisoner of Sex, it is naturally rejected as well, that is, birth control is rejected as well. If a woman has control over her body as a man has control over his, this equality is offensive to the masculine imagination. One finds this to be a primitive and resentful attitude characteristic of the desire for revenge on the part of oppressors against the oppressed. This is a curious psychological phenomenon noted in relationships in which power is an issue, where the oppressor feels guilty for what he has done to the oppressed and consequently then projects this guilt and these feelings of antagonism out onto the oppressed and feels a kind of double dislike or revulsion. Sophie, the Auschwitz survivor of Styron's popular novel, Sophie's Choice, is masochistically involved with a Jew named Nathan, who subjects her to sexual humiliations, beats her, and finally involves her in a suicide pact. However, it doesn't happen that quickly. It's really a very long novel. And if I read those things very slowly, you get a sense of the flavor of the kind of voluptuous detail one finds with the sexual humiliations and sexual humiliations and so forth. When Sophie tells her painful and highly complex history to the novel's immature young hero, Stingel, who is a fairly transparent persona for Styron himself, the narrative is most successful. I think it's a very moving novel. And those of you who read it, you remember when Sophie speaks in her own voice, she talks about her girlhood and being in a concentration camp and losing her children. It's just very, very powerful, I think. However, when Stingo speaks to us in his own voice, which is very much an adolescent boy's voice or a young man in his 20s, the elegiac tone changes abruptly, and Sophie is degraded into yet another male fantasy. In Sophie's choice, the exploitation of the victimized woman strikes the reader as more brutal than it is in Mailer, primarily because Sophie, when speaking to us, is more convincing than any of Mailer's female characters. There is something jarring, something repellent about Steinman's greatly detailed, protracted descriptions of Sophie as a sexual being, a voluptuousness that has much to do with the fact that Sophie is a concentration camp survivor and has experienced numerous unspeakable horrors firsthand. Yet here is Steinman's description of his doomed heroine, only one page after she's revealed to have been an Auschwitz survivor. Quote, "As she went slowly up the stairs, I took a good look at her body in its clinging summer dress. While it was a beautiful body with all the right prominences, curves, continuities, and symmetries, there was something a little strange about it. The odd quality proclaimed itself through the skin. It possessed the sicky plasticity at the back of the arms, especially, of one who has suffered severe emaciation and whose flesh is even now in the last stages of being restored. But none of this at all diminished the kind of wonderfully negligent sexuality, having to do with the casual but forthright way her pelvis moved and with her truly sumptuous rear end. Despite past famine, her behind was as perfectly formed as some fantastic prize-winning pear." Isn't that the most extraordinary? I know Bill Steinman, and he's you know, really a very nice man, but this is, I think, some sort of embodiment of the most callous and cruel primitive male fantasy. Despite past famine, this woman has not just suffered starvation, but all kinds of humiliations, horrible things, including the loss of her children. But despite all that, her behind was perfectly formed as some fantastic prize-winning pear. The way the paragraph is constructed, the concentration camp details are given in such a way that they feed into the final sentence, which is this prize-winning pear, which vibrates with magical eloquence. So a woman, though she suffered, and though, like Sophie, she really is a very complex personality, a woman ultimately is summed up in this physical thing going up the stairs that's prominences and curves and symmetries. I can't imagine any man being described in any way like that. There isn't, I can't think of any writer, any woman writer, unless she was being very funny or very weird or, you know, very satirical, who would, in all seriousness, in a really serious novel, this is a very serious novel, it's a very sad novel, I can't think of a woman writer who would reduce a man to such a physical simile, prize-winning pair. Near the novel's end, Stingo and Sophie actually become lovers in a set piece of particular awkwardness. It's difficult for the reader to believe that Sophie would accept the immature Stingo as a lover. Steinman himself seems incapable of making the scene credible. All becomes fantasy, superficial rhetoric, pasteboard characters, and exploitation of Sophie's past suffering. The more jarring, and that this is the last we see of Sophie, she dies in the next scene. She dies in the chapter following this. Perhaps she dies because of this. Steinman doesn't say that. Quote, The varieties of sexual experience are, I suppose, so multifarious that it is an exaggeration to say that Sophie and I did that night everything it is possible to do. What a modest statement. It's an exaggeration for me to say that Sophie and I did that night everything it's possible to do. But I'll swear we came close. And one thing forever imprinted on my mind was our mutual inexhaustibility. Our mutual inexhaustibility. And then there were all those famous positions. He doesn't go into any detail here. Without a word, Sophie presented herself in such a way as to fulfill all my past fantasies in utter apotheosis. I thought in a weird seizure of cognition of the necessity of redefining these words, joy, fulfillment, ecstasy, and God. This is an extraordinary ending for the relationship between Stengel and Sophie that it seems one has to draw back from it. There's just really nothing one can say. Sophie ultimately becomes the presentation of an experience to this male, very much along the lines of de Rougemont's postulation. Images of women explored in the novels of Lawrence and Faulkner are, however, more disturbing in that Lawrence and Faulkner are major writers in our language. But here, too, the woman of exceptional qualities is subjected to punishment at the hands of men who appear to be acting on one level, at least, in a kind of mythical trance. Quote, the quote, beautiful white woman of the chilling novella by Lawrence, The Woman Who Rode Away, it's a wonderful novella. This woman is murdered as an offering to dark gods in Mexico. Gudrun of Women in Love, who is in fact one of the very few women artists in all of serious fiction, is so finely dehumanized as to feel that she is on the brink of madness. I think, in fact, she does become mad. Faulkner's Johanna Burden, the sole woman in Faulkner's massive oeuvre to distinguish herself as something more than a mammalian fantasy like Eula Varner or a victim like Caddy Compson, is murdered by her lover, Joe Christmas, and her head is nearly severed from her body. There's a great deal in Light and August about Johanna Burden being man-like, being masculine, and she does a lot of talking and thinking, so I think probably the head being almost severed from the body is symbolic. These novels explore in considerable depth the themes of femininity and masculinity. That the woman trespasses against nature in asserting herself as an equal with the male seems to be the violation here for which she is brutally punished. Also, these women become paradigmatic. They're not individuals, but representative figures, cautionary types, warnings. The unarticulate, half-conscious, but unmistakable warning of the novels is that the exceptional woman will be destroyed. I have a great deal about Lawrence's exploration of this theme, which I think I will abbreviate here, since I won't have time. I'd like to get to the Faulkner. Now, Lawrence is far more liberal than most male writers in allowing women not only the freedom of casting off a debilitating femininity, but the experience of their own passionate natures. I mean, Lawrence, I think, is exceptional in getting into the consciousness of a woman. But the passionate natures can only be directed toward men. He is extremely punitive toward women who decide, for one reason or another, that they don't really want passion at all. Women who might be asexual or non-sexual, or women who might be homosexually inclined, make him extremely angry. Lawrence's revolutionary art makes the attempt through language to render states of mind and consciousness and sensual experience that are, in essence, impossible to suggest in words. The challenge for Lawrence is to present the fluid, mercurial, paradoxical, and frequently perverse nature of human experience, a ceaseless river of impressions, impulses, intuitions, emotions, states of mind, quick darting as fish. Women in Love was written in 1919 and is an extremely prophetic novel. I think it's as timely today as when it was written. I've written a whole essay on women and love in which I talk about the suppressed prologue. And I didn't think to mention it in this paper. But any of you who are interested in the various stages in which a novel goes through its evolution would probably be very interested to know that there was a prologue to Women in Love, which is about Birkin and Birkin's homosexual feelings, homoerotic feelings for young men, particularly of a class lower than his own, and then his interest in Gerald. Now, this preface or prologue was suppressed. It was never published. It was in manuscript for a long time. It has since been published in some special way, but it's never with a novel. So if you read Women in Love, the title Women in Love seems to be about women and love, but the real novel is about four people, two couples in different ways, two sisters, Ursula and Gudrun, and Birkin and Gerald, who are their lovers, or perhaps Birkin and Gerald are secret lovers in a way themselves. So I think it's extremely interesting that Lawrence, like many other homophobes, was fighting in his own nature homosexual inclinations. Now, the sisters Ursula and Gudrun are contrasted. Ursula is very much like Lawrence's wife Frieda. She gives herself to her lover and becomes really crushed and obliterated. She suffers the dissolution of herself. She's hopelessly dying into another and moving from the world of routine and mechanical activity into this world of an intense sexual love. It's Lawrence's feeling that unless we die to ourselves and give up ourselves and move into this kind of dark river of passion, the blood consciousness of which he speaks very eloquently, that we're not redeemed. He had a puritanical and preacher-like feeling about the redemption of sexual love, which is extremely convincing when one reads it. I think it can do some mischief in real life. If any of you, this is very parenthetical, but it's amusing, because right now, or in last month's Atlantic Monthly, Al Alvarez, the English critic, writes about how his marriage was contaminated by Lawrencian ideals of dark romantic passion that he and his wife both expected to experience, and nothing at all happened. And it was just, I think, in fact, she may have been a granddaughter, or she's related in some way to Frieda Lawrence. So when I write about someone like Lawrence and Faulkner and Yeats, I really want to write about writers who are so representative and whose works have pervaded our culture in a way that many people have actually been influenced in their lives by them. One of the interesting themes of Philip Roth's ongoing confessional fiction is how he was contaminated by thoughts of literature, of a high morality, of renunciation, of Henry James and Thomas Mann and so forth. So Ursula, I think, is the ideal woman in the imagination of Lawrence. Ursula's sister, Gudrun, however, is far more compelling in that she shares Ursula's passionate nature and arrogance and independence, but she's an artist as well, fiercely individualistic in her art. However, she's the kind of artist who invites a comparison with Faust. She is given to making statements like, life doesn't really matter, it is one's art which is central. While Ursula is all feeling and fluidity and passionate transformation from one unthinking state to another, being the ideal woman, Gudrun is all control, the male's nightmare vision of the woman who is not feminine, who is in fact an artist, a rival. Not meek, not spiritual, not submissive, not pliant, pliable, tractable, a match and more than a match for Gerald Critch, the wealthy mine owner. One feels Lawrence's hatred and fear for Gudrun equally, which is perhaps one of the reasons that she attains so extraordinary a presence in the novel. The novel itself is very luxuriant and overwritten. It, I think, gain some kind of claustrophilia, where everything is extremely overwrought and a fin de siècle nightmare. Gudrun's name is that of a mythical Germanic heroine who killed her second husband. Her fate is to kill men as Gerald's fate is to be killed. By the frost knowledge of the unsubmissive female who refuses the dissolution of love. Gudrun is repulsed by the thought of marriage and by the thought of having children. She's very negative about the idea of home life and middle class existence. She has an objective curiosity. She experiences people as characters in books or subjects in pictures or marionettes in the theater. She dissects them to reduce them to their elements, quote, to place them in their true light. She knew them, they were finished, sealed and stamped and finished with for her. It's significant that Gudrun wishes to have been born a man and that she deliberately works in miniatures, wishing to see the world through the wrong end of the opera glasses. In one of the powerful scenes in the novel, if you're familiar with it, Gerald comes to Gudrun to surrender himself in love. He becomes very much like a little child. He gives up his masculine pride, and she accepts him, except she can't share in his passion. She remains awake, destroyed into perfect consciousness. And she really represents the anguish of consciousness, becomes a monster of consciousness. It's interesting to note, though I won't expand upon it, the relationship between Lawrence's portrait of Gudrun and the decadent, with a capital D, decadent and symbolist portraits, paintings of Munch, Strindberg, and other symbolists, where the woman is very much a vampire, the idea of a woman who sucks the blood of the male and does not replenish him in any way. The seductiveness is all the more perverse in that it has nothing of natural surrender in it. At the novel's conclusion, Gudrun becomes so dissociated from herself that no action and no words are spontaneous. She's always acting, always contriving a role. She becomes a monomaniac of irony. Gudrun's hatred of life is all the more mysterious in that she is an artist, and one suspects that Lawrence's portrait is a portrait of himself, the transference projection onto the female artist, those possibilities he feared in himself. He talks about this very clearly in his poetry. He has wonderful poems. I think he's an extraordinary poet. Birds, Beasts, and Flowers, and Look, We Have Come Through are just wonderful books of poems. I think that if Lawrence had not written these great novels, he'd be known as one of the great poets of the 20th century. And in these poems, he talks about the madness of solipsism, the inability to believe in another's existence, the confinement, the hermetic confinement of the artist. And so I know he's talking about himself, but he's projected all this onto the female. In the poetry, he's very clearly talking about D.H. Lawrence, but in the novel, he seems to be talking about this woman. And Gudrun is on the brink of madness at the novel's end, in very powerful passages. How I hate life, how I hate it, she thinks. This is about the last we see of Gudrun. There she was, placed before the clock face of life. And if she turned, still she could see with her very spine, she could see the clock, always a great white clock face. In vain she fluttered the leaves of books or made statuettes in clay. She knew she was not really reading. She was not really working. She was watching the fingers twitch across the eternal, mechanical, monotonous clock face of time. She was like a little 12-hour clock against the enormous clock of eternity. Didn't her face really look like a clock dial, rather roundish and often pale and impassive? And one really feels the rush of terror at this image. And we have here a very terrifying portrait of an artist as a young woman. It's a cruel and distorted portrait, absolutely distorted, of if it's meant to be of Catherine Mansfield, as I think in part it was. We know from Catherine Mansfield's journals, the journals that she wrote near the end of her life, What a wonderful maturity and depth of personality that woman attained. She became almost mystical. Her journals are beautiful. So Gudrun is really a demonic distortion of this woman artist. And by contrast, we have Connie Chatterley, the ruddy, country-looking girl with soft brown hair and sturdy body and slow movements, full of energy, big, wondering eyes, and a soft, mild voice. I won't go into Lady Chatterley's lover since everyone is familiar with that, but the contrast between Connie Chatterley, who's slow and kind of bovine and sturdy and big, wondering eyes, and falls so deeply in love with Mellors, I think the contrast between her and this very dehumanized Gudrun is quite clear. She's redeemed by her love affair with Mellors, which follows some of the general postulates of Derougemont. It's an adulterous relationship that gets much of its energy from the fact that it's illicit. I spent some time talking about so-called unnatural love relationships in Lawrence because they arouse Lawrence's frenzied loathing, really a very interesting overreaction. There's a wonderful novella called The Fox in which two women who live together companionably are soon divided by a young man who comes along who is really like, he's the fox. He accidentally, quote unquote, kills the more masculine of the two women, and she's in a sense his rival for the other more feminine woman. Lesbian relationships are necessarily repugnant in Lawrence, for such relationships appear to circumvent the sacred masculine role altogether. Repulsed by the asexual, Lawrence is yet more infuriated by the homosexual, in women at least. The lesbian Miss Inger of the Rainbow is revealed as, quote, poisonous and corrupt, which seems a really kind of felicitous shorthand way of describing someone. It's like opening a fortune cookie in a Chinese restaurant. You take it out, poisonous and corrupt, and you know exactly all there is to know about yourself. So for Miss Inger in The Rainbow, so for a lesbian, poisonous and corrupt. We have very little reason for seeing her that way. In fact, the judgment is imposed upon her by Lawrence. She gives off, quote, a marshy, bittersweet corruption, sick and unwholesome. I have met, I'm not intimately acquainted with, but I have met lesbian women. I've yet to meet anyone who gives up a marshy, bittersweet corruption, sick and unwholesome. I think that would be difficult to attain if one could try. There's a long passage in Lady Chatterley's Lover, which I would like to read, but I don't really have time to read it. It's so funny because Mellors starts ranting and raving about women. He's talking to poor Connie, who we imagine is all big, wondering eyes and ruddy cheeks and soft bovine flesh, and he starts ranting and raving. The various women he's been involved with sexually, and almost every one of them is disappointing him. These are, then he goes through the women who want a man but don't want sex and only endure it. They're very bad. Those are Victorian women. Then there are women even worse who pretend to like sex and to be passionate, but it's all made up. Very bad. Then there are women who are unnatural in various ways which are not explained. One wonders in 1981 how this would evolve. What is unnatural in 1981? But they require lovemaking of unspecified sorts, which is very, very bad, very wicked. We don't know what these women are up to. These women are too passive. That's their problem. Perhaps some of these women are corpses. No. Perhaps the man didn't even notice. Well, no. That's an embarrassment for which the man would be quite resentful, I think. Then there are women like Mellors' former wife who are too active. You see, the passive is very bad and wicked, but the active is even worse because the active woman has usurped the natural role of the male. And she is threatening and intolerable, and a word that is used often, monstrous. Then there are the so-called frigid women who are very bad, quote, just dead inside, but dead, and they know it. You can just see Mellor's ranting. And then there are the lesbian kind. These are the worst. He just gets very angry. He says, it's astonishing how lesbian women are, consciously or unconsciously. Seems to me they're nearly all lesbian. And do you mind, asked Connie. I think this must be very disingenuous of her. And do you mind? He's, you know, foaming at the mouth for the last half hour. And Mellor says, this is the love ethic of Lawrence. Mellor says, I could kill them. When I'm with a woman who's really lesbian, I fairly howl in my soul wanting to kill her. I thought that was most amusing. And what's interesting in these very experimental and revolutionary writers, you know, Lawrence suffered so much for the revolutionary nature of his writing and his thinking. He was extremely radical, and I think, as I've said before, really wonderful writer. And so with Yeats and Joyce and others. What's so interesting is that while they were very radical in their technique and many of their ideas, their vision about the role of the artist and so forth, they were extremely reactionary or even primitive in their thoughts about women, which is either illuminating or extremely demoralizing, dispiriting. I recommend for your perusal at leisure the wonderful novella, The Woman Who Rode Away, which is a parable-like story set in the Sierra Madre wilderness. Lawrence came to the Southwest, and he lived for a while in Mexico. He almost died in Mexico. Well, he almost died in different places. But he really was very, very sick in Mexico. And he writes so beautifully about the Southwest, New Mexico and Old Mexico. He's a wonderful writer. This woman represents America. She's from California. Her conscious development had stopped mysteriously with her marriage. This marriage, of course, is a very middle-class, ordinary marriage. Lawrence expresses a loathing for her predicament, which is representative of that of her race and her civilization, the effete white civilization. Quote, she was overcome by a foolish romanticism more unreal than a girl's. She felt it was her destiny to wander into the secret haunts of the timeless, mysterious mountains and seek out the Indians. Lawrence's contempt and loathing are so strong that one feels his moralizing thumb coming down. The woman who rode away gets on a horse and she rides off into the mountains, and it's a very, very legendary novella. It has the feeling of a fairy tale. She rides to the Chiltree Indians and naively offers herself to them. She says she's tired of the white god and is bringing her heart to the Indian god. I've taught this novel on the graduate level, and when we come to this part, she says, I'm coming to the Indian gods, and the Indians say to her, do you bring your heart to the Indian gods? She says, yes, I bring my heart. You know, and then she's speaking figuratively, but they are speaking literally, and this turns out to be one of these ancient fertility rites done with a stone knife at the winter solstice, and it's described as if it were a religious ritual, which in fact it was. Do you bring your heart, white woman, to the Indian gods? Yes, I bring my heart. It's like a parlor game where you're saying the wrong thing, and then suddenly it turns into a gothic movie. It's very sadistic, and Lawrence's feeling toward this woman is so sadistic. It's really very, very painful. The Indians don't see her as a beautiful white woman. They see her as a thing, quote, some giant female white ant. Lawrence says, quote, her kind of womanhood, intensely personal and individual, was to be obliterated, and the great primeval symbols were to tower once again over the fallen individual independence of woman. The sharpness and the quivering nervous consciousness of the highly bred white woman was to be destroyed Womanhood was to be cast once more into the great stream of impersonal sex and impersonal passion. This is always from the point of view of the male. There isn't any discussion of the nervous consciousness being, if it even exists, some sort of function of both male and female. But the woman is to be destroyed in her personality and become simply an impersonal body. That is, the employment of the female by the male, the breaking of spirit, the destruction of womanhood altogether. And on the shortest day of the year in December, she sacrificed to the primitive gods. I had more to say about other stories of Lawrence's. There's one story called None of That, which is just a terrifying story, where a woman dares to express sexual desire for a bullfighter who is a very attractive man. And her punishment is he invites her to his villa late at night, and he turns her over to a gang of ruffians. And she is described as an unusual woman. She had a real personality. Quote, she had too much personality to be a lady. She had all that terrible American energy. She has money, and she's extraordinary. So she must be punished for this by this bullfighter. He hands her over to half a dozen of his bullring assistants with orders not to bruise her. And she is so humiliated and broken, we don't see her afterward. She takes poison, she commits suicide. And this is really offered up within the context of the story as exactly just. That's what she deserves for this expression of autonomy. A similar Puritanism, so far as women are concerned, pervades William Faulkner's work, and perhaps is even more extreme than it is in Lawrence. One of Faulkner's few distinctive women in all of his many books is Johanna Burden of Light in August. She's about 41 years old. She's an intellectual. Her people are from New Hampshire originally. They were abolitionists, and they came to the South. And her grandfather, or perhaps it was her father, was shot in a dispute about black voting. In other words, they're abolitionists from the North. She's very interested in promoting the cause of Negro education, and she's very different from other characters in Faulkner who are very mindless. And in the novel Light in August, which I think is a great and very paradigmatic novel, occupying a position rather like Moby Dick in the 19th century, I would put those two novels. I think Moby Dick is the greater novel, but Light in August is certainly a superb novel. But within the novel, there's Lena Grove, as her name suggests. She's very, very mammalian, and she's pregnant. She's immensely pregnant throughout the novel, and very simple-minded. She almost seems retarded, and she's pretty, and no threat to any man, and she winds up married to a good man. And then there's Johanna Burden, Johanna, her name suggesting a kind of masculinity, and Burden meaning that she's a burden. And she is also daring to have some kind of social or political feeling about the plight of Negroes, which to many of us would seem very admirable in her, but in Faulkner's extremely closed and conservative imagination, that's something that a woman, or really almost anyone, should not be doing. Johanna is viewed by Joel Christmas as two people, one whom he sees by day and the other with whom he lay at night and didn't even see or speak to at all. There are these two women who are in fact the same person. He talks to one in the daylight, but at night he's the lover of this body. He doesn't see her, he doesn't speak to her at all. It's a nightmare parody of the doubleness of the female's identity. By day, her personality is insignificant. He doesn't really hear what she says. He doesn't listen to her. By night, only the physical being exists. This is very much like what D.H. Lawrence prophesized about the obliteration of the personal. Joel enters her house at night like a thief, quote, to despoil her virginity each time anew. She is unnatural even in her surrender, quote, the hard, untearful, and unself-pitying and almost man-like yielding. She has the, quote, strength and fortitude of a man, quote, the man-trained muscles and the man-trained habit of thinking. There was no feminine vacillation or coyness. It was as if he struggled physically with another man for an object of no value to either, for which they struggled on principle alone, meaning her virginity. And she becomes really an outrage to his masculinity. He thinks, under, in italics, he does quite a bit of thinking in italics. Under her clothes, she can't even be made so that it could have happened. That's a sentence that can be interpreted in various ways. Under her clothes, she can't even be made so that it could have happened, meaning that he doesn't think she has a body, a woman's body, under those clothes. It was like I was the woman and she was the man, carrying with it the male sense of the perverse, unclean, and criminal. There is even Faulkner's musing, which crops up again and again in male writing, that rape is not possible. Rape is not possible. Faulkner seems to be dismissing the possibility of violence from the male upon the female as if there had never been any history of this in male-female relationships. There are only differing degrees of coyness on the part of the woman. Some women are so coy that they're beaten to death with a club or something, you know, and thrown in the river. That's, I think, carrying coyness to a real perverse extreme. And after he really rapes her in a sense. It's not clear what happens, but it's certainly nothing very affectionate. He thinks, quote, at least I have made a woman of her at last. Johanna Burden says in a very famous quote in this novel, it's central in Faulkner, and she's talking about blacks, but she could be talking about women. In order to rise, you must raise the shadow of the black with you, but you can never lift it to your level. The curse of the black race is God's curse, but the curse of the white race is the black man who will be forever God's chosen one because he once cursed him. What exactly these words mean, I never have been able to figure out. But you can never lift it to your own level. Well, one wonders why you can't lift it to your own level. One doubts that very much. But it seems to speak for the essential conservatism of Faulkner's imagination. But we see the curse being made explicit in terms of a kind of social determinism in which God is hauled in for reasons that don't seem to be necessary. Johanna offends Jo's sensibilities all the more in that she exhibits a forthright sexual desire, which is the province of the male. Their relationship consequently is described as filthy. The sewer ran only by night, and at first it shocked him. Her physicality damns her in Jo's eyes. She becomes very emotional. She has an instinct for intrigue. She weeps a great deal. She becomes a nymphomaniac, even more alarming than the nymphomaniac Temple Drake in The Heroine of Sanctuary, another novel in which a woman is raped and then in a way held to blame for that. Johanna waits for Jo in a darkened house, quote, panting, her eyes in the dark glowing like the eyes of cats. He would find her naked or with her clothing half torn to ribbons in the wild throes of nymphomania, her body gleaming. And one wonders how one can make her eyes glow like the eyes of cats. She would be wild then with her wild hair, each strand of which would seem to come alive like octopus tentacles, and her wild hands and her breathing, Negro, Negro, Negro. There's a great deal of extraordinary nonsense here, the grotesque nonsense, you know, the hair like octopus tentacles coming alive, and the eyes like cats' eyes gleaming in the dark, and the really meretricious allusions to various sorts of decadent manifestations, and also, I think, really very offensive, the stereotypical white woman's desire for the black male. Within 6 months, she becomes completely corrupted, and Jo himself, who is by no means virginal, Jo is already a murderer, but I suppose within the masculine domain that's hard. He's hardly soiled his hands yet. Just starting. But Joe is so offended by her that he sees himself like a man sucked down into a bottomless morass. She represents rotten richness ready to flow into putrefaction at a touch, like something growing in a swamp. It would be wonderful to meet someone like that who had rotten richness ready to flow into putrefaction at a touch, like something growing in a swamp. The relationship between the two of them descends from this affectionate plateau and soon becomes quite violent, and it ends with her being murdered. She really becomes rather, I think she becomes insane. He's very brutal to her, and finally he kills her. At the heart of Light in August, which is traditionally interpreted as an exploration of the divided psyche of the United States in relationship to the racial problem, I think it's really the familiar drama of a woman's punishment as a consequence of having trespassed against nature, that is, the male sense of his own power, domination, and sexual authority. The feminine and ceasing to remain feminine arouses not only hostility but murderous rage and revenge. In these magnified and almost caricatured terms, Faulkner dramatizes the most secret conflict between men and women, which is unadorned by subtleties and nuances. And I just can really just conclude now because we're running out of time. I think it's extremely instructive that these experimental writers should be so primitive in certain of their assumptions regarding women. It's nothing short of remarkable how closely akin they are in many respects to the stereotypical notions of popular culture, not only of our own time, but of the 19th century. This I found the most amazing, that the 19th century's notions of women are carried over into these outstanding and revolutionary experimental writers. It's disguised much of the time, and yet one finds it there nonetheless. To tear this prejudice out by the roots seems to me an admirable aim, indeed a necessary aim for all of us, men and women alike. I think to be realistic, we have to recognize how deeply rooted it is in all of us. It is in women, too, the notion of a woman being somehow inferior to the male. Many, many women feel this way, consciously or unconsciously. And if I'm not greatly optimistic about the prospect, I'm not unduly pessimistic either. At the very least, the experience of bringing submerged contents into consciousness is a healthy and instructive exercise. Thank you.